Chapter 72. Underworlds. James Island is a half-square mile of territory out in Chesapeake Bay, and apart from a US quarantine station, its inhabitants are mostly seeker deer. It was in 1956 that a scientist named John Christian went to study the deer. Five of them had been transported from the mainland in 1916, and 40 years later they had increased to a herd of 300. And then, 2 years after Christian's arrival, a strange thing happened. The deer began dying off at an astounding rate. More than half of them died in 3 months. By the middle of 1959, there were only about 80 deer on the island. And then the deaths stopped. What was so puzzling was that there appeared to be no obvious reason for their deaths. They looked healthy and well-fed. Christian had shot a number of deer when he first arrived on the island and made a detailed study of their internal organs. The only obvious difference between these and the more recent deaths was that the animals that died in 1959 and 1960 had enlarged adrenal glands, in some cases nearly twice as big as in the shot deer. The adrenals are the glands that flood the system with the hormone adrenaline when confronted with a crisis. Christian's observations indicated that the deer had died of stress due to overcrowding. Yet in realistic terms, they were not overcrowded, around 1 to 1 acre. All the same, that was enough to produce a condition of continual stress that caused hemorrhages of the glands, brain and kidneys. It was nature's way of controlling the population. The deer is a non-aggressive animal. Its response to overcrowding is to give up and die. One writer on ethology noted the same thing affected some American prisoners in Korea. They would become dull and lethargic and die of convulsions. It became known as give-up-itis. In more aggressive species, the response to overcrowding is crime, violent and often pointless aggression. The researcher, John Calhoun, observed that overcrowded rats became rapists and cannibals. When slum areas of cities became overcrowded, a certain proportion of their inhabitants, usually about 5%, develop a kind of alternative society, a way of life that's based on crime and which is taken completely for granted as a social norm. An underworld develops. It's an interesting observation that the underworld of a city seems directly related to its population. Before the 1917 revolution, the Russian port of Odessa had a flourishing underworld, and it's described, humorously, in stories by the writer Isaac Babel. By comparison, communist Russia had no underworld, and this was only partly due to the totalitarian system, which reduces crime by reducing the freedom of the individual. The basic cause was the fact that as the Russian population expanded, a new city was built in the wilderness to house the overflow. Russia has well over 200 cities with populations of more than 100,000. By American or even English standards, these are little more than villages. Consider, on the other hand, that New York has a population of more than 12 million, that Hong Kong has more than 4 million, and Calcutta nearly 5 million, and that these cities, crammed into a relatively small area, also have the highest crime rates in the world. One statistician calculates that by the end of the present century, Calcutta may have as many as 60 million inhabitants. It's currently expanding at a rate of 1 million every 3 years. If this actually happens, Calcutta will be one immense, seething hotbed of crime. It's necessary to understand all this if we are to understand the frighteningly steady growth of the underworld in the 20th century. In the 1850s, a sociologist named Henry Mayhew undertook an enormous study of the habits of the London poor, and he produced 4 big volumes describing them. If we turn to the sections on London's underworld, they seem absurdly anticlimactic compared with modern organised crime. There are accounts of prostitutes and their bullies, pickpockets, shoplifters and thieves. Types of robbery described include stealing from street stalls, stealing from clotheslines, breaking shop windows, and child stripping, that is, enticing a child into a dark alleyway and stealing its resaleable clothes. This underworld was run on a strictly amateur basis. The real professionals, it seemed, were the fences who bought the stolen goods. The last real attempt to organise crime had been made more than a century earlier by the notorious thief-taker Jonathan Wild, who was basically a highly successful fence. Wilde had been executed in 1725, in the days when the commonest crime in England was highway robbery. By halfway through the 19th century, a fairly efficient police force had made the highways safe, and besides, the great majority of travellers now went by rail. So crime had contracted again into the heart of the great cities. Glasgow, Liverpool, London. But it sprang out of poverty rather than from any antisocial resentments. The same was true of most of the great crime cities of the world, including Paris, Berlin, and New York. In these cities, there was no room for a crime explosion. The police knew most of the habitual criminals. In Paris, the Sûreté was even run by an ex-convict, Vidocq, and when he began work as a police informer in around 1809, Paris had a number of gangs of efficient thieves. By sheer cunning and skill, Vidocq broke up most of these. On one occasion, he joined the gang run by a man called Constantin, posing as an escaped galley convict from Toulon. When the gang arrived back from a burglary, Vidocq had the police waiting for them. It was America that gave birth to the first truly organised crime. The Chinese tongs, which originated in the goldfields of California in the 1860s. They were originally intended as protection societies for the Chinese, who were hated by the white Americans, as were the Mexicans. Inevitably, they began to live off their own people, and protection took on its modern meaning, extortion. There were plenty of gangs of desperados in all the major cities, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, but they usually controlled a small area, perhaps only a single street. And then, in the 1870s, the Italians began to create their own secret societies, or rather, they brought them from Italy. In Italy, societies like the Camorra had been formed for the protection of citizens, since the police were underpaid and subject to political pressures. In America, the Camorra became the Black Hand, and then the Mafia. It began an organised despoliation of the Italian community. New Orleans was one of its major breeding grounds. After the murder of the police chief, David Hennessy, in 1890, and the subsequent acquittal of the nine accused, the irate citizens rose up, broke into the jail, and lynched the malefactors. And for the time being, the power of the Mafia in America was broken. It soon revived, however, this time in New York. In 1902 and 1903, there was a sudden wave of murder in the Italian colonies of New York City. Bodies were found in sacks, barrels and boxes. In many cases, the tongues had been slit in two, indicating that this was a gang murder whose aim was to impose silence. The victims had been talkers. The gang's code of conduct was harsh and brutal. Giuseppe Morello, a Sicilian gang leader, had his own 18-year-old stepson kidnapped and tortured to death because the boy had let slip some of his stepfather's secrets. Most of Morello's large income came from a counterfeiting ring, whose products went all over the United States. The downfall of the Morello gang occurred shortly after this. Its most feared members were Morello himself and two lieutenants known as Lupo the Wolf and Petto the Ox. On April the 13th, 1903, a woman strolling past a lumber pile on the edge of the Italian section of the Lower East Side saw a barrel, with an arm and a leg protruding from it. When the police opened it, they found the body of a man whose head had been almost severed with one powerful slash of a razor. The fact that his ears had been pierced suggested that he was a Sicilian. He wore a watch chain, but no watch. A detective who saw a photograph of the murdered man recognised him as an unknown who had been seen in the company of the Wolf and the Ox in an Italian restaurant run by Pietro Insarillo. The detective had been shadowing the Wolf and the Ox. Good detective work soon led them back to the Italian restaurant. The barrel, with sawdust in the bottom, scattered there to soak up the blood, had contained onion skins and butts of Italian cigars. It was traced through the manufacturer to a wholesale grocer, who had supplied it to Insarillo's restaurant. A brilliant Italian operative, Joseph Petrosino, was assigned to the case. He went to Sing Sing to interview a convict named Di Priemo, an ex-member of Morello's gang, now serving time for counterfeiting. When Di Priemo saw the photograph of the murdered man, he wept. It was his brother-in-law, Benedetto Madonia. Mrs. Madonia later identified her husband's body. Detectives went to question Lupo at his wine shop. Lupo instantly pulled a stiletto and was about to plunge it into the throat of a detective when another policeman grabbed his arm and dragged him to the floor. Lupo was arrested, and so were Petto the Ox, Morello, Insarillo, and several other suspects. In Morello's house, the police found a letter written by him to Madonia shortly before his death, saying that he was tired of this dangerous work of distributing counterfeit money, and he intended to return to his family in Buffalo. It was clear that he had been killed because he knew too much. But the inquest on Madonia revealed something of the power of Morello and his Black Hand. Madonia's son was to identify his father's watch. There was an ominous shuffling of feet in court, and a man rose to his feet and placed his finger to his lips. Madonia's son stammered and was suddenly unable to swear that the watch was his father's. Mrs. Madonia also seemed to lose her memory when the shuffling began. Di Priamo was brought from Sing Sing to testify, and he declared with an air of apparent frankness that he was certain that the ox had not killed his brother-in-law because the ox was one of his oldest friends. And so all the suspects went free. However, the New York police were determined to get them behind bars, and not long after, Morello and the wolf were arrested and charged with counterfeiting. And, although the evidence seemed thin, a judge sentenced them to 25 and 30 years, respectively. Inzerillo was picked up on a charge of altering his citizenship papers and was sent to prison for a longer term than the offence warranted. In fact, reading between the lines of the account given by ex-Deputy Inspector Arthur Carey, it looks as though the police stretched the letter of the law to get the killers of Madonia behind bars. Petto the Ox moved to Browntown, Pennsylvania, but in October 1925 he stepped into his backyard and was cut down by 5 shotgun blasts. Coincidentally, Di Priamo, the man who had sworn to get the killer of his brother-in-law, had recently been released from Sing Sing, his term of imprisonment commuted for exemplary conduct. When Inzerillo came out of prison, he opened a pastry shop. Shortly afterwards, he was also killed by an unknown intruder. It became increasingly clear to the American police, and to politicians, that the problem of organised crime started in Italy. A member of a committee from Congress was told by the police chief of Palermo that Sicily had very little crime. He asked why, and was told, seriously, "Well, most of our criminals have gone to America." In 1907, Joseph Petrosino went to Palermo to see what could be done about close cooperation between the Sicilian and the American police. On the day of his arrival, he was shot down in broad daylight outside the Palazzo Steri, the Court of Justice, by the head of the Sicilian mafia, Don Vito. Vito, of course, had an unshakable alibi and was never charged with the murder. That round of the fight had definitely gone to the mafia. Ever since the 1870s, America had been convulsed by violent labour disputes. In many ways, this was understandable. The accounts by Jack London of his own early days as a stoker make it clear that labour was ruthlessly exploited. The American success ethic meant that an employer had no pangs of conscience about keeping a man on a starvation wage and dismissing him and allowing his wife and children to starve if he could get someone at an even cheaper rate. The commercial world was a jungle, the title Upton Sinclair gave to his great novel of corruption in the Chicago stockyards. With fighters like Sinclair, Jack London, Clarence Darrow and Eugene Debs, organised labour slowly began to make some headway against the big corporations. Although strikes were often long and bloody, and imported strike beaters were sometimes ambushed and murdered by angry workers. And as organised labour finally began to establish its right to exist, the thugs moved in. In New York, all the major industries were controlled by gangs: the docks, the garment industry, the gambling houses, and the brothels. The protection racket, which had developed in New Orleans in the 1870s, was now a recognised and established business. The gangs fell into 3 clear groups: the Jews, the Irish, and the Italians. The Chinese, who had once been New York's leading racketeers, had long ago been forced into a minor position. In the autumn of 1912, East Side clothing workers went on strike. At least, most of them did. Some were not militantly inclined and continued to work. Labour leaders, who were always hand in glove with racketeers, approached a Jewish gangster, Dopey Benny Fine, to send some strong-arm boys over to persuade these recalcitrants to join the strike. However, the clothing bosses had also bought protection from a couple of gang leaders named Tommy Dyke and Harry Lenny, an ex-prize fighter. It was an absurd situation, with both sides of labour represented by mobsters. Dopey Benny's chief lieutenant was an Irishman named Joe Miller, who, to demonstrate his freedom from racial prejudice, had renamed himself Jew Murphy. Murphy was told to interview Dyke and Lenny and to order them to withdraw their protection from the clothing bosses. One of Dyke's men punched Murphy in the face and threw him out. Murphy swore revenge. A month later, at the opening of the 6-day bicycle race at Madison Square Garden, shooting started between the 2 gangs. Luckily, only one Lenny henchman was injured. Commissioner Arthur Woods, who had recently been installed in office, realised that next time the innocent bystanders might not be so lucky. He proved to be an accurate prophet. Trouble came on the evening of an annual ball given by the Dyke and Lenny gang at Arlington Hall, near St Mark's Place. As Dyke and Lenny were about to swagger up the steps of the hall to meet a respectful reception committee, firing suddenly broke out behind them. They leapt up the steps and into the hall. For the next 10 minutes, the air was full of bullets, and when the shooting stopped, a man lay dead on the pavement. Frederick Strauss, a court official. Woods was furious. The gangs were going too far. Not long before, he had to send a whole contingent of police into the Carbarn district of the East River because the Carbarn gang had put up notices declaring that no police would be allowed into the area. The Carbarn gang had been broken up, and now he was determined to do the same for the Dopey Benny mob and for the Dyke and Lenny Association. His first problem was to find out how the fine mob had managed to get hold of their guns. Most of them were known to the New York police and were likely to be stopped at any hour of the day or night. If they were found in possession of a hidden weapon, it usually meant at least a year in jail. So Woods was reasonably sure that they had not gone to Arlington Hall carrying guns. The underworld grapevine brought him the answer. A girl named Annie Britt had carried 7 guns in her handbag. She was one of the first gun moles on record. Woods ordered the arrest of 7 members of Fine's gang, including Annie Britt. The trial was a fiasco. Most of the testimony came from gangsters, and it conflicted so much that the accused men were acquitted. Nevertheless, police harassment had its effect. During Woods' administration, the gangs almost disappeared. Dopey Benny's gang broke up as a consequence of the case. Woods had proved that the police could break this new kind of organised crime if they simply harassed enough. Then America entered the First World War. Many of the gangsters went off to fight, and New York crime dropped. When the soldiers came back home, there was a crime wave. There usually is after a war, but the police showed themselves able to cope. For a while, it looked as if the pattern of organised crime in America might be broken. Unfortunately for America, there were powerful forces at work in support of crime, forces that believed themselves to be on the side of law and order. The temperance movement began in America as long ago as 1770, when a member of a Quaker meeting in Philadelphia protested that he was oppressed by the smell of rum from his fellow Quakers. Rum was one of the most popular medical remedies of the time. By the 1830s, temperance had become a powerful movement in England as well as in America. Dramas like The Drunkard and 7 Nights in a Barroom brought in massive crowds in the 1840s and 50s. But England, with its usual genius for compromise, declined to embrace strict temperance. The Americans, as usual, preferred to do things the hard way. Hot gospel revivals had always been an American speciality. Now the Anti-Saloon League, represented at national level by Senator Andrew Volstead, succeeded in declaring all forms of alcoholic liquor illegal in the United States as from January the 17th, 1920. Prohibition had arrived, and with it America's last chance, in the 20th century at least, of beating organized crime. The story of Johnny Torrio, Al Capone, Dutch Schultz, and the other gang leaders of the bootleg era has been told many times. The problem was that they had the average American citizen on their side, that the man in the street thought it was stupid that this democratically elected government should deny him his finger of whiskey or gin. In effect, Capone and Schultz were voted into office by the people. Organized crime gained the stranglehold that it has held ever since. It may yet prove to be the most serious challenge America will have to face in the last quarter of the 20th century.